I don't buy every conspiracy theory out there. In fact, you might say I'm a curious skeptic. But there is just enough evidence to consider the possibility that the powers that be are manipulating us like so many pawns on a chessboard. That's why we hear the theories out on Jim Harold's Conspiracy Corner. Welcome to the Conspiracy Corner. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you today. Now, when the term conspiracy comes up, I think people tend to think in modern day terms, maybe that, you know, the first conspiracy was the JFK assassination. If you do indeed believe that, it was a conspiracy. By the way, I do. But anyhow, conspiracies go back far, far further than that. And we have a great guest to talk about the history of conspiracies. He has a recent book out. It's called The Conspiracy Book, A Chronological Journey Through Secret Societies and Hidden Histories. And I'm talking about our guest today, John Michael Greer. John is a widely respected author and blogger in the fields of nature, spirituality, and the future of industrial society. He is the author of more than 50 books and his blog, and I hope I get this right, Eco Sophia, and he lives in Rhode Island, and we're talking to him today. John Michael, welcome to the program today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, first of all, I want to talk to you about the word conspiracy, because I think more so now than ever, it is truly the scarlet letter. I mean, you bring up the word conspiracy, and automatically people think you're a kook. And that's I think that's very unfortunate, because I think, and as you point out in this book, that if you look through history, conspiracies are not made up of whole cloth. I mean, they are sometimes, but there are such a thing as conspiracies, and they've played a major role in history. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. The thing is, human beings have been doing things in secret since about the time we came down from the trees. And that's all conspiracy is something, you know, a group of people get together in secret and decide, okay, we're going to do this, and we're not going to tell anybody. That's normal human behavior, and it's been normal human behavior as long as we've been human. Things can get a little funky, of course, when people start getting fixated on thinking that you know, everything is done by conspiracies, right, or that there's one big conspiracy responsible for everything. There, you know, and that's I think has a lot to do with why conspiracy theory has you know, developed the sort of reputation it has. But come on, the assassins who killed Julius Caesar did not publicly announce that they were going to do it. Okay, they got together, they made their plan, they caught him in an appropriate place, killed him, and booked. It was a conspiracy.
Yes. Well, it, to me, it's gotten to the point where someone could say, I'm a Satanist cannibal, or I'm a conspiracy theorist, and they'd be far better off if they said they were the Satanist cannibal. Sure, come on in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Would you mind taking a bite out of one of our neighbors?
Exactly, exactly. But you're not a conspiracy theorist, are you?
Now, at least you're not a conspiracy theorist.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I just thought of that. That's pretty good. This goes way back. In fact, you start your book before the birth of Jesus Christ.
Of course. We don't know a lot about many of the conspiracies from ancient times, partly because, you know, records from a long time ago are difficult to come by. But on the one hand, we know there were conspiracies going on in ancient times because a few of them are fairly well recorded. The assassination of Julius Caesar is again a classic example. It's also important to keep in mind that there are things that happened and traditions that got underway back in quite ancient times that ended up becoming important to secret societies later. In a bit, we should probably talk about the difference between a conspiracy and a secret society, because they're not quite the same thing. But so my book actually starts with the building of the Temple of Solomon. That was not done by a conspiracy, but later on, a whole bunch of secret societies, including the Freemasons, made that central to their ideology. And so, you know, I need to reference, you know, look, here's where this set of ideas gets started. It gets picked up here. It goes there. You know, goes back a long ways.
Now, usually conspiracy is thought of as a negative, but let me give you an example. Now, during the Second World War, the Allies had essentially a conspiracy to invade Europe via Normandy and so forth. And there were all of these different kind of deception tactics put out and inflated tanks and things to make make the Germans believe it was going to be, I think, a Calais. Now, the thing was, that was a conspiracy.
That was like, a conspiracy. That was an amazingly successful conspiracy. Operation Bodyguard. Yeah. In fact, the British military had an entire department that was dedicated to nothing but faking out the Germans. And they did all kinds of amazing things. They came up with the most preposterous sets of roundabout ways to leak fake information to German intelligence, and the Germans bought it. And so, you know, to a very real extent, Winston Churchill ran a conspiracy that shortened the war by probably a couple of years.
Yeah, so I guess I'm just trying to get around that idea that a conspiracy is always bad. It's like anything else.
Like anything else. Here's another example. Any of us who live in the United States and are glad that we have, you know, these sort of institutions, representative government and things, we owe that to a couple of conspiracies. The Sons of Liberty and the Committees of Correspondence, the two organizations that arranged the American Revolution, were conspiracies. In fact, they were secret societies. You know, so when you go out and watch the fireworks and have a hot dog or what have you on the 4th of July, you're celebrating two of the most successful conspiracies in history.
And people forget that.
People forget that.
One organization that caught my eye here, and you see this many times, and they're supposedly, not supposedly, but they're members of the ruling class that are part of it. I think of people like John Kerry, George W. Bush, Skull and Bones. And that's a very loaded term. But tell us the reality behind Skull and Bones.
Okay. I think most of our listeners know about college fraternities. If nothing else, probably most of them have seen reruns of Animal House at some point. Okay, the big prestigious top of the line universities in America, primarily Harvard and Yale, have their own equivalents. And just as you join, you know, Delta 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 or whatever it is, and you know, you have connections with other alums of that fraternity ever after. When this happens at Yale, it's a big deal because the people who go through, say, Skull and Bones, who are in that fraternity, which is what it is, they are support each other, and they support each other across the generations. So, you know, you get out of graduate from Yale, you've been a member of Skull and Bones. Well, you know, there's a guy in the Department of State who is also a Yale graduate, Skull and Bones, who graduated 20 years earlier, and he's in a position to help you get a nice job at the State Department. And that's the way it works. Very often, these connections through secret societies, through fraternities, through fraternal orders like the Freemasons and so on, these are very useful to people who are trying to claw their way up the various ladders of power in American society, in every other society. The interesting thing is Harvard also has its own set of things, but for some reason, nobody's really caught on to that yet in the conspiracy research field.
I mean, in essence, isn't it just basically the good old boys club? Isn't that what we're really talking about?
Yeah, we are talking about Animal House with a much, much, much bigger budget. Okay, and perhaps not quite so outrageous in their behavior, because, you know, they all know when they graduate they're going to be going to work for big corporations or really big government agencies or running for Congress or something, and so they don't want to give their opponents too much ammunition. Still, I thought it was charming that George W. Bush, in a speech of his at Yale, said, you know, like me, many of you will not remember everything you do during your college year.
That's funny. Now, speaking of current day or more current day politics, when I look at the political landscape today, I think actually this name could fit both parties. Talk to us about the Know Nothing Party, because I remember I studied it on maybe a half a page in like eighth grade history, but I've totally forgotten. What is the Know Nothing Party?
Nobody talks about the Know Nothing Party. Okay, back now we're talking in the 1820s. Okay, immigration was a big deal in American politics in those days. Immigration has always been a big deal in American politics, but it was a hot issue, and at that point, the big issue was. People coming from Catholic countries. Most of the people who came over and founded America were Protestants, okay? And they had a lot of distrust for the Catholic Church in those days. And so the idea was that the Catholic Church was sending over these swarms of immigrants who were going to Catholicize America, very much the same attitude that you see toward Muslim immigrants today, for example. And the Know Nothing Party, as it was originally, there was a couple of fraternal organs, a couple of lodges, a secret societies were founded to fight the Catholic menace and oppose unlimited immigration from Catholic countries. And they were secret societies. They had the passwords and the secret handshakes, the whole nine yards. But as they got larger and consolidated and turned, they had this rule that if anyone asked them about the organization, the only possible response was, "I know nothing." Now, this may remind you of Sergeant Schultz.
I know nothing, I see nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think he was a member, but so what happened, of course, is that as they got larger and larger, they did what secret societies always do when they can get to the point that they can make a jump to actual power. They came out of the secret society closet, turned into a political party. They invented the idea of having a convention. A national convention for the party to select its candidates. The Democrats and Republicans picked that up from them later. But, of course, the Republicans weren't around yet. But so they turned into a party, which was, you know, the American Party, I think was their official title, but everyone called it the Know Nothing Party. And they ran, I think it was 1852, they ran a candidate for president. They lost. They got their clocks cleaned. And unfortunately for them, the popular mood was shifting. More people were interested in the business over slavery. And so their third party status, they were kind of shoved into minor parties with the rise of the Republican Party, which was focused on abolishing slavery. So they never really got that far beyond that. But a lot of the same ideas that were in circulation with the Know Nothings ended up being picked up by other secret societies in American history after that, and ultimately helped feed into the foundation of the Ku Klux Klan later on.
Now, speaking of that horrible organization, just because not all secret societies are bad, they're not all bad. There's certainly some horrible ones, one you just mentioned being one, the SS being another. What are some of the nastiest conspiracy groups or secret societies in history, in your view?
In history? Well, obviously the Klan is a really good example. But the ones that I tend to bring up as the horrible example to keep your eyes open about anything like it are the secret societies in Germany and Austria that helped bring about the rise of the Nazi Party. There were a bunch of them. There was the Order of New Templars, there was the Germanen Order of Germans, there was the one that people still remember these days, the Thule Society or Thule Gesellschaft. And these were organizations of people who were, you know, who had essentially the same beliefs that the Nazis had, that the Jews were responsible for everything bad that ever happened to anybody, that Germans were the Herrenvolk, the master race, that basically blonde blue-eyed Aryans, that is to say, people who didn't look like Adolf Hitler, were superior to everyone else and should rule the world. And they also they had this very ornate mythology that drew on a lot of occult traditions from that time. But they were getting active in the late 19th century, and they spent the entire first quarter or so of the 20th century circulating their propaganda, getting their ideas out there, spreading these notions and so on, and building an infrastructure of people who were in favor of it. Now, the Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society, they were based in Munich, and in 1918, I think it was, right after the German defeat in the First World War, they founded a political party, the Front Group. Okay. It was called the German Workers' Party. Sounds nice and radical, right? And it was in 1919, I think it was, that it recruited an Austrian vet, relatively young guy who nobody had ever heard of before, named Adolf Hitler. And he became they recruited him. They said, hey, this guy can speak. This guy has real powerful oratory skills. Put him to work. And they literally paved his way to power.
Frightening. And the thing is, and there's a great Twilight Zone about this, it mm-hmm. is this concept that it can't happen again. It can happen again. And I'm not just saying in the States, anywhere in the world there can be, and there have been, dictators who uh-huh. have come to power. So I think this kind of feeling, that was back then, and people easily had the wool pulled over their eyes, and it can happen again.
The thing is, dictatorships happen all the time, and they happen, these days especially, they happen when democracies stop paying attention to what's actually going on in the countries. When you get a ruling class that's convinced that they know what's right for the country, and who cares what's happening in, say, the flyover states, then, people turn to somebody who will upset the apple cart, and they'll go as far as they have to. The thing that made it possible for Hitler to get power was that in the Great Depression, the various German governments would do anything but actually try to help, the German people deal with this horrible economic situation. And the Nazis were, one of the things people don't remember is that the Nazis were out there, like, running soup kitchens. Seriously, they provided a lot of help to ordinary Germans at a time when the sort of elite classes, the educated, intelligent people who knew what was going on were going, who cares what's happening in Bavaria? And so they rose to power. Anyone who thinks it can't happen here needs to take a look at the attitudes of our political class toward what's happening in our flyover states.
Yeah, scary times indeed. Now, this is one I want to ask you about, because there's this one photo. I've seen it many times. If I remember correctly, maybe Ronald Reagan is in the picture. Walter Cronkite's in the picture. The Bohemian Grove.
The Bohemian Grove. Yes.
Yes. And that large owl effigy that they set on fire. What is the deal with that?
Okay. We start in 19th century San Francisco, the Bohemian Club. Gentlemen's clubs were a big deal in the States. You had these various clubs. They had bars. They had restaurants. They had rooms where you could stay when you were in town. There were dozens of them in any city of any size. And a city like New York or London, there were hundreds. So the Bohemian Club started out as just one of those. And this was just before San Francisco really started taking off as a major city. And it so happened that the Bohemian Club ended up becoming the club where the really rich families all belonged to. It became the upper class, the upper crust of California society. They then bought basically a campground, but think campground with a really big budget, where they held this summer retreat for a couple of weeks every summer. Guys do that. No women allowed. People were sneaking off, of course, to prostitutes in the next town, but it's off the what's off the campsite, we don't worry about. So they had, and in the typical 19th century way of things, they were doing the same kind of, if you went to summer camp, okay, there were these various rituals and things like that. So they started with this thing called the cremation of care, be gone, dull care. We bring all these cares with us because we're rich, we're influential, we're important. And so there's this sort of ceremony where they cremate a large owl, which represents the cares that they are letting go of for the period of 2 weeks. Exactly what else might have piled into the ritualism is a heck of a good question, because that's one of the things you get in a situation like that. The rituals pick up new meanings. People do fun things with it. To some extent, it's just a bunch of fireworks going off. But keep in mind that during that two-week period, movers and shakers from all over the United States and some other countries are showing up to hang out and talk and make deals and, have conversations that are not on the record. So a lot of things do take place there. And if you're sufficiently influential male in the United States, you go there.
I've not been invited yet. No, and I won't be, and I never will be.
I have no expectation of ever going to the Bohemian Grove. You know, I did summer camp when I was a kid. I'll pass now.
Now, another one you cover, and I was surprised to see this, but I guess I shouldn't be, is the Mafia. I mean, it's a definition of a secret society conspiring.
It started out. As a secret society. It started out in Sicily. It's actually a network of secret societies. And the thing is, one of the things that secret societies will do, and this has happened in many parts of the world, is, you know, when you're secret and you know you can get away with stuff and you have people in various places will cover for you, the temptation to get into a little bit of illegal activity is kind of hard to resist. And as one thing leads to another, it's happened many times that secret societies that started out for other purposes morphed into crime syndicates. And that's basically what happened with the Mafia. Of course, you know, it came over with Italian or Sicilian immigrants in the early 20th century and established itself wherever there were significant Italian-American communities. And it became, there were previous criminal mobs in the United States, but they didn't have there's actually a ceremony by which you become, a member of a mafia family. They didn't have the ceremonies. They didn't have things like that. Like the old Irish mob, you showed up, you held your own, you did what you were told, and you were a member of the Irish mob. But yeah, the mafia has definite secret society elements to it.
When you see movies and TV shows mm-hmm. about the mafia, Sopranos, I'm just watching a kind of a latter day, very similar to Sopranos, not quite as good, but pretty good, Bad Blood on Netflix, which is a Canadian show and those things. What are your thoughts? I'm assuming beyond writing on this, you've done probably a good deal of research. Are they pretty much on point, or do you think a lot of it's just Hollywood in terms of the mafia and how it operates?
If it comes from Hollywood, you can assume as a matter of course that most of it came out of some scriptwriter's brains. I haven't watched the show that you mentioned, but I would be surprised if it has. I mean, for example, how important is Catholic religion in the lives of the mobsters there? The actual mafia, it tends to be very, very devout. That surprise a lot of people, but you know, one of the reasons they've been able to hold their own so well for so long is that mafiosi who have some money donate a lot to the Catholic Church.
Now, on the other side of the coin, something that is generally thought of very positively, something like the Shriners. Talk to us about the Shriners.
Yeah. Okay, to get to the Shriners, we have to start with the Freemasons. Okay. Because the Shriners are an offshoot of that. So we have the Freemasons, which started out as basically a trade union in the building trades in medieval Britain and Scotland. So, you know, these are the guys who build cathedrals. They have a kind of guild organization. Like most guilds of the time, they have rituals of initiation. But because they're builders, you know, they know a lot about sacred geometry. They know a lot about symbolism. And when the guilds started falling apart, as happened as the Middle Ages started turning, giving way to the early modern period, the old stonemasons guilds hung on in some places, and they started bringing in members who weren't stonemasons because they had all this stuff about sacred geometry, all this stuff about symbolism. And so over about 100-year period, the old stonemasons lodges morphed over into Masons lodges. They went from being operative Masons to what they call speculative Masons, Masons who are working with the symbolism, with the traditions, with the rituals and so on. And of course, everything got made much fancier and Masonry went its merry way to become the largest secret society in the world today. I am a Freemason, so I'm not going to be giving away any official secrets.
Well, that's what
there aren't many. You can find the secrets of Freemasonry if you want to, with a little bit of time in your favorite search engine. But so we have Freemasons. We're 19th century America. There are Masons lodges everywhere. If you go out into the West, visit old ghost towns in the West, you're going to find a Masonic lodge in most of them. Long abandoned, it doesn't matter. It's still there. So we have Masons all over the place. We have some Masons who are quite wealthy. We have some Masons who are quite wealthy who want to get together and party on a regular basis. And in some of these in New York got together and they cooked up, they came up with their own ritual, and because it was very standard at that point to have these additional ritual degrees that you could only get into if you were such and such degree Mason and so on and so forth. It was kind of a self-feeding process. And so they came up with the Ancient Arabic Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, which is the full name of the Shriners. And for the first 75 years or so, maybe a little longer than that, the Shriners were in the business of having fun. When the Shriners had their national convention in a city, every bar in the place ordered double the stock of alcohol, and prostitutes came from six states around.
Oh, my.
Because they knew. Oh, no, it was wild. Unfortunately, well, or fortunately, as the case may be, somewhere in the course of the 1930s, I think it was, the Shriners got, as and this is something that happens to a lot of these whoopee clubs, they got a sense of morality. They said, you know, we should really, we've got this money, we're having this fun, but, you know, we should also put aside some money and so on to help people. And so the Shriners went to work, they because they were rich, most of them. Back in those days, you couldn't become a Shriner unless you had a fair amount of money. So they started throwing money into building free clinics for children. That was a cause in those days. Of course, it still is. And because they had a lot of money, they built a lot of free clinics for children. And they're still running them. Of course, what happened was that gradually the Shriners got a case of creeping respectability, and they stopped drinking quite so, well, most of them stopped drinking quite so heavily, and the prostitutes were a little less apparent, obvious to conventions and things like that. So they got all respectable, and at this point, the Shrine is, it's large, it's very wealthy, it has falling membership. You know, obviously spending all of your time helping to support free clinics for children is less attractive than drinking yourself blotto and hanging out with prostitutes. So they're having trouble retaining membership, but they're still there.
Is that something you're seeing with most secret societies like the Masons, like the Shriners, that it's kind of declining? Yeah. Because there's so many other ways to entertain yourself these days.
Well, the thing is, there always were. The problem with a secret society is that it has to revive itself, it has to revitalize itself at intervals, or it's going to go sliding down and lose the appeal that it once had. You know, Masonry's trying. The Freemasons, some of the jurisdictions, brief note, there is no central headquarters of Masonry in the United States. Every state has its own individual Grand Lodge, which is prickly independent from everybody else. Rhode Island, you know, which is a tiny little state, has the Grand Lodge of Rhode Island, which is completely independent of every other Masonic body. Huh. It's quite funny. But some Masonic jurisdictions have managed to figure out what younger men are interested in and are providing it. And as a result, you know, memberships are up. People are, you know, young men are coming and going, wow, this is really cool. And this, the thing is, this has happened before. Masonry has to retool itself about once every 50, 60 years. Some jurisdictions are sliding fast. Some other fraternal societies are not doing so well. A lot of the, you know, a lot of the, even ones that were very big in, say, 1900, some of them have gone out of existence, and many of the others are just hanging on by a fingernail. The Klan, for example, is nothing like what it was back in its
thank goodness
glory days. Such as, oh yeah, I'm not arguing. I am sad about one thing though. One of the things I wrote about in the conspiracy book is that when the Klan really hit its stride in the 1920s, a lot of people who were opposed to it organized anti-Klan secret societies.
Hmm.
So you had this warfare between competing secret societies. So you had the Klan on the one side. On the other side, you had the Order of the Flaming Circle. You had the All-American Association. You had my favorite secret society of all, just because of the name, the Order of Anti-Poke Noses. Yeah.
So they would go in. They would go in opposition to the KKK.
This organization was founded in rural Arkansas, and it was people who were opposed to the KKK because the KKK stuck its nose into everyone else's business.
And sounds like a good group.
Exactly. I hope someday somebody turns up a copy of the ritual of, say, the Order of Anti-Poke Noses or the Order of the Flaming Circle, which was basically dedicated to constitutional government and the rule of law. And no, you can't get away with terrorism just because you wear a white sheet. We could use that. We could use that kind of thing again. And, you know, secret societies go in and out of fashion, but if you don't have the power to pursue a political agenda right away, if you need to build the ground, if you need to lay foundations and spread ideas, the secret societies are a good way to do it. And so they always keep coming back into fashion sooner or later.
So secret societies don't necessarily equal bad. They can also, like anything, like a book. A book can be bad.
Exactly.
It can incite violence. It could be good.
It can be good. Exactly. The secret society is a technology. It's a toolkit, if you want to call it that. And you can use it for anything. There are secret societies that exist solely for the purpose of doing good in the world. There are secret societies that exist for doing monstrous evil. And everything in between. It's simply a toolkit, and what you make with the tools depends on what you want to make with the tools.
Is there a secret society that you studied that you wish more people were aware of, good or bad, that more people knew about, that nobody knows about, whether it's historic or current or whatever?
Oh, let's see. That's a real challenge. I think I've already touched on the anti-Klan secret societies, which I wish many more people knew about. Beyond that, I think it's not so much that I wish that people knew more about some specific secret society, but I wish that people who were thinking about conspiracies were aware, as you've pointed out, that it can be used for good as well as for evil. And that it can also just be used for something simple things like community support. Back in the day, immigrant communities used to have their own free fraternal societies, which had their secrets, they had their passwords and so on. You'll still find in some places things like the Sons of Hermann, which is a German-American society, or B'nai B'rith, the Jewish society, started out as an ethnic secret society. And there were all these organizations. They helped build community. They helped people take care of each other in hard times. People would pool their money, so there'd be an emergency fund if somebody took sick or somebody had an emergency. It could be taken care of. And I think that's the thing I'd like people to be thinking about when they think secret societies, instead of going, oh, they're out to get us all. It's a matter of, well, you know, we could do something like that. And we could do something like that for all these good purposes. Why don't we look into this interesting toolkit? Why don't we see what we can do with it?
Very, very interesting. What a great show, and what a great expert you were on this, and giving us a whole new appreciation of this.
Well, thank you very much.
And this book, what is it? You have 50 or 60 different, or even more than that?
I have 100 vignettes. From the history of secret societies dating back to ancient times right up to the present. The publisher and I tried to make it easy to read, fun, well, gorgeous illustrations. Sterling has a wonderful illustration department. They came up with just the marvelous thing. It's a good light introduction to the world of secret societies and conspiracies, and one that I think I've done my best to be even-handed and show both the good and the bad that comes out of that.
The book is The Conspiracy Book, A Chronological Journey Through Secret Societies and Hidden Histories. John Michael, where can people find the book?
You can find it at your favorite full-service bookstore. You can find it from your favorite internet bookstore. You can contact, Barnes & Noble has it by the truckloads. The publisher is actually Barnes & Noble's House Press. So I will put a plug in. Visit your local Barnes & Nobles if you've got one nearby, and you will find it sitting there, bright red and ornate covered, and they would be happy to sell you one.
Very good. The book is The Conspiracy Book, A Chronological Journey Through Secret Societies and Hidden Histories by John Michael Greer. Thank you for joining us today, John.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you for tuning into Conspiracy Corners. And watch out, because there may be, and it may be good, but there may be a conspiracy right around the next corner. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.